All right, so I'm going to talk today about why we would bother to communicate risk, and I'm going to focus a lot on a chapter from this book, Communicating Risks and Benefits, an evidence-based user's guide. It's a book that the FDA makes available for free online. I'm one of the editors of the book. I also have chapter 2 in there, and that's what I want to talk about, is the content of chapter 2 with a little bit of a Web 2.0 spin on it. But the main focus here is not so much data, and I appreciate having seen some data here, and I'll give a little bit of data, is more a larger argument about what the point of risk communication is, and maybe we can pull something out of that for the Web 2.0 context. So there are lots of different kinds of communication out here. Here's one of the kinds that I hate the most. This is a package insert. So this is what you get when you buy, when you're prescribed a medication. You look to see what that little piece of paper says. It's pretty impenetrable. We have a lot of conversations about these with the FDA. Here's another kind of risk communication. Here's a woman looking at her mammogram results and trying to make sense of what it might mean. Here's yet another kind of risk communication. This is Tom Robinson's fish market in the town next to mine. He doesn't like people parking in the spaces, taking up the spaces where his customers would park. My husband has an office there and sometimes ended up parking a little too close to Tom's fish market. All right, so let me propose that there are three broad activities we could engage in, or three broad directions we'd be going in when we talk about risk communication. We could be doing the risk communicating, the getting it said part. We could have a desire to actually change risk beliefs, and that's broadly construed. Or we could be trying to change risk-reducing behaviors of some sort. And let's take each of those in turn. So there are some benefits to having a model like that, some kind of a picture or a cartoon in our mind, especially a simple one that we can walk around with, one that's not too hard to operate. It gives you these explicit goals for risk communication. It gives empirical evidence for plausibility. You can go look for that. And then, of course, the most important thing that I want to leave you all with today is the idea of evaluation. Now, I know some of us here are research scientists who like to publish in journals that no one reads, not even us. And many of us here are practitioners who are out there actually making a difference, who are out there in public health programs at the local or state level. And I'm going to be speaking a little more to you, although researchers here, you all can listen too. So this first piece, communicating risk. So the general goal here is just to say it, just getting it said. In talking with the FDA, I've managed to get them to agree for the most part this may be an unacceptable goal for risk communication. This kind of thing, just getting it said, getting it out there, checking off the box in the legal liability clause saying, well, we put it out there that this information was found in this particular clinical trial, and here's the chemical composition. I hope you all have boned up on your high school chemistry. But it really doesn't get us very far, does it? So just saying it is the goal here, just getting the word out there. And is this known to be effective? It kind of depends. Effective at what? Is just saying it effective at saying it? Well, I guess it is. But maybe that's not really the point. Maybe that's not the thing to do. Maybe the point is to have a different kind of outcome in mind. So, yeah, program evaluation for this. If you want to evaluate your program to figure out, did you do it? Well, yes, actually, you did do it. But there's no impact there, and there's no kind of impact evaluation you're likely to be able to think about. Now, that said, there are a couple ways of thinking about just saying it that may matter. There are times when communities derive great benefit from coming together and just saying it. That may actually be a desirable outcome. In environmental risk communication, that is often a key goal, is to activate the community into caring. Whether or not they understand is a whole other issue, but to get the conversation going. Now, thinking about Web 2.0 as a context, we have a slightly different issue here. There's a lot of people just saying it. And once something comes out, the cat's out of the bag, and you really never know when something's going to enter the echo chamber and really start resounding louder and louder and louder. Earlier this week, I happened to be giving two identical talks on HPV vaccine in the same day, because that's one of the areas I do a lot of research in. Exactly the day that the findings came out on suggesting that African-American women may derive somewhat less benefit from HPV vaccine. And the findings were extremely far from that conclusion. They were HPV serotype findings, had nothing to do with vaccine efficacy. And yet there we were. This was the conversation that I got to have all day long, and then all night long, in emails with colleagues, in a press release, and all the rest of this as the whole thing continued to melt down. So information, once it gets out there, does have a resonance, but does it have an impact? That's a really very much an open question. It certainly can drag policy around. It can change the opinions of policymakers who care about these conversations about people just saying it. So what about this next thing? If we want to just say it, maybe we actually have something more in mind, something more fundamental in mind. Maybe we want to change how things land, where, what things are in people's heads, what's in their minds, what's on their thoughts. So that could be a second goal, is changing the awareness of an issue, changing what people know about it accurately, defining, yes, they know this piece of this particular fact or that particular fact, or just the beliefs, the hunches, the intuitions that they carry around, or even possibly the attitudes, their warmth or negative evaluation of behaviors and other things that you may want them to engage in. So here we go. So this is filmmaker Joanna Rudnick, who has presented a positive test for the BRCA mutation. Okay, so then I'm not sure how it lines up exactly with this image right here. So, but we're talking more broadly about breast cancer testing. So you'll know that BRCA 1 and 2 are markers for a genetic mutation that increase your risk of having breast cancer, of developing breast cancer and potentially ovarian cancer. It's not an increased risk for all women. It depends a little bit on who you are. So one of the things you can do is you can try to assess how well these sorts of risk communications work. And are they effective? Yeah, they're sometimes effective. Sometimes. So here's an example of how they're sometimes effective. Okay, here's data from Germanken et al. From the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2005. These are women who were given BRCA1 and 2 testing. So their actual risk is maybe around 23%. The risk they recall being given was around 30%. But when you ask them, no, really? What is your risk? It's about 45%. So people are resistant to risk information. If it really was just that easy to tell everyone smoking kills, I wouldn't have just gotten a $19 million grant to go study how to tell people smoking kills, right? It's pretty hard to get risk information across, to get it to land, to get it to be understood, to get it to be internalized so that people go walking around with it in their heads. Not so easy. It turns out there are some situations in which it works really well. Now, these are women who are ostensibly healthy, the women on the left. Now, here's some more data on the right from women who have breast cancer, who want to figure out whether the breast cancer is going to come back. They're given a genomic test called Oncotype DX, and these are some of my data. Their actual risk is about 13.2%. Their recalled risk is about 13.3%. Their perceived risk is about 13.7%. They were on, spot on. They knew exactly what was going on. There was no question about an inflation of risk. They had it precisely in their minds what was going on. It worked pretty darn well. These are women for whom it mattered a lot. They were making a decision about whether or not to have chemotherapy. It's a big decision. Chemotherapy causes cancer as well as cures cancer. Risk of chemotherapy, cancer risk of chemotherapy, there are different estimates out there. But, you know, if you want to throw out the numbers 1 or 2%, those would not be unreasonable numbers. And if you have a low breast cancer recurrence risk, you might actually be in the neighborhood of 1 or 2 or 3%, and you might not want to have chemotherapy. But if you have a high recurrence risk, maybe you're at 40%, maybe you're at 37%. For those women, having your risk cut in half by chemotherapy is highly motivating. They want to know whether they're in this high-risk group, a low-risk group, or somewhere in between. All right, so if you want to affect risk beliefs, maybe it matters if you did change risk beliefs. Did it work? You want to go assess that. And of course, this sort of approach is focusing on psychosocial outcomes. That's of particular interest. Now, here's where we start to have a problem in a Web 2.0 world. It's hard to know what people are getting as a result of our communication. In this sort of echo chamber, you can have a few voices that sound quite loud. So one of the things that I do is I study what people believe about HPV vaccine causing sexual disinhibition, the idea that getting HPV vaccine will turn your daughter into a prostitute. So data hasn't really worked out in the way that one might think based on the news. There's no evidence of that. Let's just start there. There's not even evidence the parents even really believe in it. 1 in 10 parents across many studies believe in this, but when you read the newspaper or you look on the web, that idea is quite prevalent. So trying to disentangle what is a meme, what is common parlance in social media or among the voices that yell loudest doesn't really get you to knowing what many Americans believe, what most Americans believe, or even what's true. So then there's the last idea. What if we actually wanted to change behavior? there's an idea. I'm in the Department of Health Behavior, so I care a lot about behavior. We sort of privilege that in our department, but I'm not saying that things like shared decision-making aren't important. They're fundamentally important, and there are certainly plenty of contexts where they're very meaningful, and I just shared one. Breast cancer decision-making is extremely difficult to do. Highly stressful situation, tons of information coming at you, and when the physicians are talking to you, your oncology team is talking to you, it's very easy to settle into a state where all of it just sounds like blah, 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 cancer, blah, blah, cancer, blah, blah, blah. So those are helpful. At the same time, we still need to keep in mind there are lots of places where we know what the right answer is, we know what we want people to do, and we should be encouraging them to engage in those health behaviors. So Tom Robinson should have gotten his flu vaccine. This was around the time of the bird flu, the avian H1N1 epidemic. So he died of that. He didn't actually get the vaccine that might have helped him from that. So Tom Robinson had a good idea here. He understood that the idea of there are different kinds of risk here, that it's gonna hurt you and it's gonna be likely. That's what he's trying to get at with the sign. It's me and I'm coming at you. He didn't get the other messages, unfortunately. So risk-reducing behavior, the goal is to change risk behaviors. Clear that's something we want to do. It's a good idea. Is it effective? If we want to change behavior, should we be engaging in risk communication? I'm going to tell you no. I'm going to say don't bother. I'm going to say do it last. If you want to change behavior, there are a lot of things you might want to do first. Risk communication is not the first. Risk communication is what you do when a bunch of the rest of the stuff fails. The FDA knows this very well. When there's tainted spinach out there, they work with a manufacturer and they recall that stuff. They get it off the shelves. That's the first thing we should do. We should set up policies. Rather than him putting the sign up, he should have put up a gate and said you only come in at this time and at this time. So set up a healthy environment, a healthy default that circumscribes the behaviors that people can engage in, if that's possible. And if that's not possible, or even if it is possible and it's not going to catch everyone, then backfill that with some kind of health communication or some kind of risk communication. That can be powerful too. There's no question about that. So we want to focus on behaviors when we're thinking about risk communication in my mind. And we want to maybe first think about whether risk communication is the place to start or the place to end. And often I think it's the place to end or somewhere near the end of the process and the end of our thinking. In a Web 2.0 world, what do we do when we're talking to people over the web and we're just observing behavior and trying to get some sense of what they're actually doing? I think that Google Trends data are some of the most exciting in this area, where they've managed to figure out actual flu epidemics. They're able to track way ahead of where the CDC was able to the outbreak of flu in very specific geographical areas. You can also get a sense of whether people are thinking about stopping smoking by looking at trends and searching. There's a lot of interesting traces in the online behavior of people that allude to behaviors that they may be engaging in or about to engage in, or the health problems that they're experiencing. Those sorts of approaches certainly need a lot of refining. That's, I think, one of the most exciting areas that we have at present. So I'll give you an example of a misspelled slide. That's amazing. Flu shot shortage. We can spell here. Okay, great. Here's some of my data from ages ago. This is the 2004-2005 flu vaccine shortage. And so what we did is we interviewed folks in 2004 in the fall, and then again in 2005 in the spring. They came in four groups. And so I'm going to walk you through what the groups are. So the first thing is, did they believe they needed to get a flu shot? Was the belief in their mind? And on the left, it's a no, and on the right, it's a yes. So the people who needed at the time to get a flu shot were essentially people who had some kind of chronic condition. Now, what was that? Well, Jay was the head of the CDC at the time. He'd know. He and I've had this conversation, not head of the CDC, but head of the communications part of it. But anyways, this wasn't his fault. But most people had no idea. Most people had no idea what group that was. So if you had diabetes, was that part of it? Actually, yes, it was. If you had asthma, well, that sort of makes sense. I guess that was part of it. And there's actually a list of four or five key chronic conditions. But if you had a chronic disease, that was you. If you were over 65, you were also one of the key folks. And then if you were a caretaker for one of those first two groups, you were supposed to go and get the flu vaccine. Those are the main ones. And pregnant women, there's a couple other groups as well. But those are the three main categories. So what we have here is the people on the right believed they needed to get a flu shot because they believed they were in a risk category. And on the left, they on the left, they didn't believe they were in a risk category. And then on the color of the bars themselves tell us whether they actually were in a risk category. And let me remind myself if I shaded these. I did. Okay. So on the far left and the far right, so the far left is the white bar with the 108 over it. They got that right. They were not in a high-risk category. They didn't get a flu shot. And they knew it. So, I mean, knew they didn't need it. On the far right is the shaded bar with the gray bar with 90 at the top of it. And that one says that they were a member of a high-risk group, and they knew it. And if you look all the way over to the left now, you can see that their vaccination rates were about 70%. All right, so that's looking pretty good. Now, this next bar in, the gold one with N equals 4 at the top of it, well, there's pretty much no one there, so I'm not going to really talk about them, but it's an error in belief. The most interesting one to me is that about a third of these people, this is a national probability sample of 300 Americans, about a third of the folks in that smaller bar there, about a third of the overall sampler in that smallest bar, those folks were members of a high-risk group who didn't know it and didn't get a flu shot as a result. Total failure of risk communication. That is to say, roughly half of the high-risk people didn't know it and didn't get a vaccination as a result. So that's the sort of thing we certainly do need to work out, is that when we get this information out in the 10,000 different ways we get it out on the web and through various spokespeople and Twitter feeds and the rest of it, that we make sure it's in a simple form that people can get. And I will say the CDC has gotten quite sophisticated about it. Their current materials are clear, and you actually can see yourself in these guidelines. So, you know, if all goes well, we'll get everyone lined up. They'll all have big hair and get their vaccines, right? All right. The final thing I'll say, and I like to share this page, and certainly for the folks who like to study vaccine hesitancy, you'll appreciate this. This is a book from 1878, 150 Reasons for Disobeying the Vaccination Law, by persons prosecuted under it. Right? Vaccination has been around for 200 years. People have been writing books like this for 200 years. We're not going to get everyone. We don't need to get everyone. We can get most people. I really like the data that, I can't remember, was this session or the last session I was in, showing that around 9% of people were not willing to get vaccinated against HPV vaccine, I think it was, but the rest of the folks are willing to think about it. We think a lot about these parents who are not hesitant, but flat out resistant, will not do it under any circumstance. But that leaves out that big middle range of hesitant, maybe, willing to be persuaded, it's on their mind. And I think those people we should certainly spend time thinking about. So where are we on time? I could stop or I could chatter for a second more. All right, so the book, I mentioned the book. It's a good book. It's free. Get it? All right, so what works? What does work for risk communication? I'm going to focus on, this is not necessarily a Web 2.0 answer, and I apologize for that, but these are a couple of things that I've thought about and noticed in the literature. One is that people understand the information. They like narratives very much. They like stories being told. A lot of for example, the anti-vaccinationist sentiment comes out in stories, and then the CDC and others come back with talking heads like me bobbing up and down and spewing statistics, and it just doesn't resonate in quite the same way as when you can tell a story about how your mom died of cervical cancer and that you wish she'd gotten the vaccine when she was a girl. All right, verbal messages can work sometimes. Images, of course, can be very powerful as well. Images, as you've seen in this talk, they can capture imagination. They can very quickly grab people. And that's one of the things about the web that is so powerful and quite a bit different than many other campaign channels we've had before. Of course, if it's personally relevant, it's going to be more powerful. Giving people a course of action. One of the things we know from the 60s, going back to the 60s, is if you scare people, it doesn't do much. If you scare people and tell them what they can do, then actually it can have an impact. And then finally, there's a funny little thing you can do, is you can make people feel good about themselves. You can affirm their sense of themselves, and then you can scare the dickens out of them. It actually works better. So this self-affirmation work has a long history to it, but we can build in some of these self-affirmation approaches, and interactive media is ideally suited to that. It may have more impact. All right, I'll leave you with the model. Let's think about just saying it, but maybe even then let's think about evaluating about what people think, and then maybe even think about what they are going to do and what they indeed do, and then maybe think about additional approaches beyond risk communication. Thank you very much.